How many bases do you have, and what are they?
I have about, at last count was about 25 bases.
Wow.
I have, over the years, I've never been a collector per se, of just wanting to collect different things. I've always been looking for the greatest bass, you know. So in those travels, it's led me to a lot of different instruments. It started with, let's see, I had a Fender Precision bass. One of my first Fender basses was a jazz bass that I got at a flea market in Miami. It was a 1964 jazz bass that is actually one of my main instruments that I record with. I recorded with Sting with that bass, with Duran Duran, a ton of session work in New York, as well as the Joan Osborne record, Relish, that I played on, Sophie B. Hawkins. It's just a great groove bass. And that's a real mainstay in my stable. So I had that. And then in the late 70s, I started experimenting with fretless basses, and a builder named Mike Padula, who is in Massachusetts, and we have a great relationship, and he's built a number of instruments for me. I have, you know, there's actually a Mark Egan signature model, and building up to developing that model, there were many incarnations of it, and it sort of evolved, but along the way, I've had doubles of everything, because whatever bass I was using on the road, I had to have one at home in case anything happened to it, I could get it, you know, just if I had to send one in for repair. So I always had a backup. So I'd say that probably two of my main five-string fretlesses, three fretted basses of Padula's. I have three double-neck basses, which was another experimentation that I recorded on my Touch of Light record, as well as, let me see, what other records? All of my records I've played a little bit of that on, except with the exception of the last trio record.
So out of all the basses that you have, do you have a favorite?
I do have a favorite. I have the one five-string fretless that I play all the time. That's a green bass, emerald green, one of my favorite colors. And I have an exact duplicate of that in a fretted version, which I use if it calls for more of a staccato funk, you know, rhythmic attack. So those two basses are my main basses. And then it branches off from there to, say, my Fender jazz bass, if it's a recording session that needs to be more of a retro sound, more of a real R&B sound. And then when I do more specialized things, some of my main basses, I have an eight-string fretless bass, which I've played on a lot of my records for melodies. And so that's another main bass. But the main one is the five-string fretless.
So you're not only focused on jazz recordings, you tend to vary your playing, it seems.
I've done a variety of things. You know, I'm from the baby boomer generation. I grew up listening to a wide spectrum of music, from Jimi Hendrix, Cream, Beatles, to Ravi Shankar, Miles Davis, to Albert Eiler, very avant-garde, to completely...
you recorded with Albert?
No, I listened to
him. Oh, you listened
to him. And I played in those scenarios.
Yeah,
but playing with the Gil Evans Orchestra was a lot of very avant-garde playing as well. So I have a lot of interests, and I don't have any musical barriers, really, as far as, oh, I only play in this style or that style, or because I love so many different styles of music. You know, I'm really open to them, and as a result, it's led me to different areas of recording in that way. And being in New York and on the New York scene, I was... from probably 1976 through today, I've been active on the New York recording scene, doing, you know, from very job-like things like playing on commercials to movie soundtracks to a number of records and, you know, different projects, assorted projects.
Is there still someone out there that you would really love to play with that you haven't played with yet?
You know, there are a number of people. I'd love to play with Eric Clapton. That would be a great thing for me. I've been so fortunate to be able to play with some great people. There are some people that have passed away. I wish I could have played with Miles Davis.
Yeah.
And Elvin Jones would have been one I would have liked to play with. That would probably be the first person that comes to mind.
Yeah. Now, the bass has come a long way since the days of Jimmy Blanton and Walter Page. And I always see you as being part of that new breed of bassists like Stanley Clarke and Victor Wooten and Jaco Pastorius, who were trying to take the instrument from a relegated timekeeper to a status of more in the front of the band.
Yes, I grew up, I was originally a trumpet player, actually. So when I was in high school, junior high school, actually from elementary school from age 10, when I was 15, I started to play bass. And at that time, my first influences were the music that was on popular radio. And at that time, there weren't as many barriers, or it wasn't as separated as far as this style and that style. I mean, you had FM radio, you could turn on, you could hear Jimi Hendrix, and on the same station, hear Miles Davis or Cream or the Beatles or Ravi Shankar, all the people that I mentioned, or Alan Watts reciting some very esoteric writings. And so I just picked up from everything. And I think some of my first influences that got me into bass, even though I was a trumpet player, was listening to the music of Motown. And I didn't know who the bass player was at that time because they never listed the players on the records, but I later found out that it was James Jamerson, which, amazing, by the way, a little aside, I was just in Detroit last week with Larry Coryell, and I went to the Motown studio in the museum. It was fantastic. It was great. But, that was my sort of the beginning of it for me, and I went to the University of Miami, and I really got introduced to jazz and to jazz bass, and I switched my major to bass. And when I did that, I got into the whole evolution of bass, it started for me with people like Paul Chambers and Jimmy Blanton and Ray Brown from a real functional groove jazz background on the one hand, and on the other hand, I was listening to the contemporary music of the time and Miles Davis and the electric players that started playing with him around Bitches Brew. And I started to see what was the... what I thought the role as a foundation player was for bass, and I felt a responsibility to get that happening in my own style and my own playing. And then when people like Stanley Clarke came along, and when I went back and listened to people like Scott LaFaro and Jimmy Blanton and people that were stretching it beyond just the groove aspects of it, I started to really gravitate towards that without leaving behind my commitment to being a rhythm section player and being a part of the groove. And so this was, to give you some dates, 1969 was when I started the University of Miami. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot going on in music at that time. There was a big, Miles was turning it over with Bitches Brew and Fusion, wasn't really titled as Fusion then, but it was a fusion of sorts. He had the beginning of the Mahavishnu Orchestra. So all those musics were influencing me. And I remember first hearing Stanley Clarke, and I was playing acoustic bass as well as electric at that time, and I thought, wow, he's taking it to another level, and I was very attracted to that. And so, I have been attracted to the potential of the bass and having it being a melodic instrument, but I look at it as, I was thinking about it the other day, and I look at bass playing as like a big pyramid, and, the base of the pyramid is this really solid foundation. And as you go to the peak, that's, you're soloing and everything, but it's all based on a foundation so that when you play with, good time and functionality at the same time, as well as expressing yourself. Because to me, the bass it's like a cello. It's a beautifully melodic instrument. And I like to, there's no reason not to explore the possibilities of that. And I think the demands of today's music have, catapulted it into that realm and brought it into the forefront. But again, I have a big commitment to the groove, and sometimes I don't like to step out, and I like to just percolate with a rhythm section, and that's fine with me. I could do that all day if it's the right rhythm section, And sometimes I don't want to hear a bass solo. I don't need to play a melody. I just want to play the groove, because I realize that playing a groove for me is a very of the moment and a very infinite feeling, and I'm very satisfied with being in that moment of time. It's a timeless place. That's a very great place to be in.
When you talk about the pyramid of the bass over time, one of the great early bassists that I really admired was Pops Foster, who was more in the traditional jazz vein.
Yes, but also played great grooves and great melodies. Yep.
Yeah, definitely. Was your one of your first professional stints, was it with Pat Metheny's group?
Actually, my first professional stint. When I was in Florida at the university, I played with a lot of people who came through Miami. I did a lot of shows, and some of the first people that I toured with, one of the first was Red Fox, the comedian.
The comedian, yeah.
And he had a musical director, Harry Sweets Edison, who, great Harry Sweets Edison.
Mm-hmm.
That was a small big band, and we toured a bit, maybe for about a month with him, and that was probably my first professional tour. What a great way to start off, you know?
No kidding.
It was a great band, and just he was, Red Fox was so funny and so dirty, filthy, rotten.
Yeah, that was
But he was the hippest guy to be around and you know, like a musician. So that was great. And I played with people like Bobby Rydell and Frankie Avalon and a lot of the South Philly people. But when I moved to New York in 1976, my first real professional job was with, after that, was with the Pointer Sisters. And I did a tour with them. I came back from that, and I was in New York at that time. And then I went out with Diodato, who... the piano player who had the 2001
Space Odyssey.
Exactly. And I did two tours with him. One was in Australia for a month, and one was a month in Mexico. So that was interesting. That was in 1976. And shortly after Diodato, I got asked to join the David Sanborn Band.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great experience because I was starting to do studio work in New York, and being asked to be in that band sort of catapulted me into being a real, you know, first or second call session player. And at that time, there was a lot of studio work in New York. I mean,
it was really busy around that time.
Very busy. You know, for me, I would do, the busiest week for me was 21 record dates in 1 week, you know.
Wow.
And that's as much as I cared to do.
Yeah.
That's, you know, three a day every day, you know. And so it was very busy, and that band was a great band. It was with Hiram Bullock, and Victor Lewis was a drummer. It was a good experience. And about 6 months after I did that, and I did a record with him called Promise Me the Moon, my old classmate from Miami, Pat Metheny, was starting his group. He had left Gary Burton.
Right.
He had done a record for ECM already called Watercolors with Eberhardt.
Maybe.
And he had also done Bright Size Life with Jocko, and he started the Pat Metheny Group with myself, Danny Gottlieb, and Lyle Mays.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big decision for me to leave David Sanborn because it was a very secure feeling. I was accepted in New York. I was, you know, in one of the best bands in New York or anywhere, really, well, R&B definitely. Bands. And to leave at that time, you know, you have to understand Pat was unknown, basically. He was known in the Boston circles, and he was known on the ECM circuit, so people who listened to that music. But I think that was a small listening crowd. But what changed my mind was I went to Boston, and he said, well, why don't you come up and we'll rehearse and we'll play. And I went, and we played, and I said, I'm in. This is great. I always have wanted to be, and always have surrounded myself around creative music and experiences all through college. I was always very much into a lot of improvisation and trying to find new ways to do it, having been inspired by Miles Davis and all his players and the bands and the movement of Miles at that time. So it was a big decision. I had to call David Sanborn and say, you know, I'm leaving the band. And, you know, he said, okay. He said, who are you playing with? Pat Metheny. He goes, who's that? You know, I said, I know it probably doesn't make sense, but I have to do this. And, you know, he respected my judgment on it. And so we went out on the road. We were literally unknown. And we traveled in a van, and we played about 300 days a year all over the United States. And then I think the next year we went to Europe to record that first album, which is just self-titled The Pat Metheny Group. It's a white album. And so, you know, that was my really big positioning on the map of music, was playing with that band. That really got us around, because we traveled all over the world. I was in the band for 4 years, and literally 300 or more days a year.
And those compositions on the early Pat Metheny albums that you were on, they really rocked. They were really solid creative pieces for that period in time.
They were. You know, we had been playing on the road that music for about a year, so we knew the music. And we basically went in and played it down. There were very few overdubs. It was all first or second take. And there was no editing, really, or punching in. It was just a performance. And so the band was rocking, and I think you get that from playing every night and the camaraderie of, you know, traveling like that. And we had honed it in, and we were all very, and Pat especially, inspired, being aware of dynamics and working on the sound and the groove, and having, I had been already done a lot of work in New York and studio work. So, you know, we all had awareness of the groove, and yeah, it was great. Four great musicians, you know, or people that were inspiring to be great musicians, I should say.
You were talking earlier about Miles Davis. Now, he really left an incredible legacy for musicians like yourself, and that whole era of musicians that came after him. What was the importance that Miles Davis had on you as a musician?
Miles, to me, was the fountainhead of what I wanted to pursue. At the time I listened to him, I was more of a trumpet player than I was a bass player. So that drew me in even more, because of, I really was attracted to Miles' sound, and I was more attracted to the directions and the movements of music that he created, and the way that he changed directions of jazz to me. I know a lot of people, when he went to the electric bands, were lost by it and didn't really want to hear that, but I opened my arms to it, and actually I started to get into it in about 1969, so I had to backtrack to go back to the earlier Miles and all the different bands that he had, Live at the Blackhawk and the bands with Coltrane and with Charlie Parker, to sort of catch up to things. But it seemed to make total sense to me, and I was just, that's the type of music that attracted me. It had an extreme creative edge. He had all the greatest players in the world as far as improvisers and rhythm section players. So it just seemed like the best there was to me, and always has been since then. And I think that was Miles's magic, was putting together combinations of people and coming up with something new. That's big. Not many people do that.
And, you know, I still think that Miles is still the benchmark even today when you go back and listen to his music. It's so contemporary and so current.
I agree totally. As a matter of fact, I just ordered the On the Corner Complete Sessions. I just got it the other day, because I want to hear everything. I want to hear outtakes. I want to hear mistakes, because I wanted to be at those sessions, you know?
Yeah, I can imagine.
You know, I wanted to, I love hearing it all, even though it's not that polished and there are mistakes and things. But so it's great for me, because I was really a big follower of that style. And I was very lucky, because I got to play with the Gil Evans Orchestra for 8 years. And that was from 1982 to 1990, actually, until Gil passed away. And that was the closest for me to playing with Miles. And in some ways, it could have been even closer, because Gil was at all those sessions. Gil was Miles's mentor. And Gil Evans was at all the recording sessions, and Miles really looked up to Gil. So to be around a mentor like Gil Evans was incredibly
You were in Gil's band when he was playing Hendrix, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and I always found that really incredible, how Gil would sort of take a Hendrix piece and just arrange it so well. That was his strong point, wasn't it?
It was, and I think other strong points of Gil was the way that he arranged wasn't necessarily the notes on paper, but the people that he had. So he brought those people in, and that was the arrangement, you know, similar to Miles. And not that there weren't notes written down, because Gil, I had an incredibly exhilarating experience. I did the music to the soundtrack. It was with Tom Cruise and Paul Newman, where he's a pool shark. What was that movie?
Oh, The Hustler?
The Hustler, yeah. No.
No, or something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it'll come to me. I can't think of it right now.
Oh, the Color of Money? Was that it?
The Color of Money.
I think that was it.
Yeah, Robbie Robertson was involved with the soundtrack.
Right.
And we were in the studio for that, and Gil wrote a piece for that. And it was just he brought in a lead sheet, and it was just, you know, the lead sheet had four or five notes, harmony across the thing, across the page. And he started to assign people different notes. He'd say, okay, trumpets, I want you to play unison mutes on the top note. Okay, the next note down, I want the French horn player to play it, but up an octave. And I want the trombone players to play the bottom note up two octaves. And then I want the flutes to play the third note and trill it, make a trill. All of a sudden, it sounded like Sketches of Spain. You know, this is just a piece of paper. But by his vocal and the way that he knew how to orchestrate and
exactly.
and put the instruments in different places, and it was really amazing. And also, Willie Dixon was on that session. I got to play with Willie Dixon.
Oh my God! I was going to mention him because he was a bass player as well.
Yes, and a great of course a blues so I was in the studio with Willie Dixon, and that came about where he just started singing parts to us. He said, "Bass, you know, play this," because he didn't know our names really. And so you go boom, 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 you know, and then drums, play this, you know, and guitar, and all of a sudden it was this whole thing that was happening, and then he played harmonica over it. I think that part happens when he's making a comeback, and they're at the pool table, and music on that tune. But so playing with Gil, getting back to that, was very close to being with Miles, because Gil played him our stuff in the band, and we toured with Miles and Gil on the same bill. We did a number of tours in Europe and in Japan. So that was a great experience for me. You know, I feel so fortunate, and I feel that all the experiences that I had at the University of Miami playing a lot of avant-garde music and learning a lot of the basics of jazz, that it all came together with Gil's band.
Is there a moment for you that you remember working in the studio that really stands out?
Probably recording the Pat Metheny group record and being in it and watching it at the same time go down, you know, if you know what I mean. Sometimes you can be, you know, you're in a conversation with someone, but your mind is watching you talking to this person as you're talking, you know. But not that I wasn't in the moment, but realizing that it felt like something special was going down, you know. I think a lot of the records, recordings that I did of my own music, including my most recent one, the trio record with John Abercrombie and Danny Gottlieb, those were some really magical moments, because there was a lot of improvisation on the record. And those were some memorable moments. There are a lot of them.
What did you learn the most from Pat's playing?
I learned mostly from Pat his individualism and the spirit of finding your own sound and your own style, because he really did that. You know, he's got heavy influences by Wes Montgomery and a lot of different jazz players, Jim Hall. But, you know, when you hear Pat, you know it's Pat, you know, and I think that inspired me a lot. And also, he's a fountain of melody. That was just... But it's not lick, it's licks, but it's his own licks, you know, and that's the thing that I work on when I practice, is try to come up with lines and not necessarily copy that many other people's lines, other than people like Coltrane and Miles, which I go back and I do transcribe and steal, like everyone has, you know, emulate. All the best of them have. But that's what I learned from Pat, I think, was his use of his styling and his use of dynamics and how far that can go.
Yeah. I'd like to talk to you about the other Pat, Pat Martino.
Now,
you spent some time with him as well. A very different style than Pat Metheny's. What did you learn from him, and how did that tour go?
I did a number of tours. I was with Pat Martino for about 8 months, and we played in the States and Europe and Japan. And that was an incredible experience. I've always been a huge fan of Pat Martino, and from his early records, all of his records, and a real thrill to play with him. He's an icon to me. He's one of the great guitarists, and a lot of people have emulated his style or attempted to. And, you know, one thing I felt from Pat Martino, aside from the fact that he always sounded great to me, he always sounded incredible, is he always played for keeps. If we were to sound check, and he'd count off a song to get the sound going, he played like it was the end of his life. It wasn't like, you know, okay, play a note or something. He burned. Wow. He never did not burn. He always burned. And when I say burned, you know, he it was as if he was playing the most intense solo in any recording you've ever heard him play.
So
really,
that's the best way to get the most out of a musician then, when you're playing that intensely.
Absolutely. That's when you're playing full out your highest intensity. That's when your creative levels are in giving the most output. And he was great playing with him.
I'm just thinking of John Coltrane with his quartet. You know, John was such an intense player.
Yes.
And you listen to the way that Elvin and McCoy and even Jimmy Garrison were just not only playing along with him, but totally in the moment.
Yes. You know, yes, and it's a great thing to be in the presence of someone that great and to be a part of it. And with Pat, he really liked the rhythm section to lay down a foundation. And, you know, in that instance, I didn't have many bass solos, but to be honest with you, I didn't really want any because Pat's playing, you know. I mainly stayed down in the first five frets of the bass and played the groove most of the time. So it was like playing with a freight train. Really?
Wow, that's a good way to describe it.
It was like playing with a freight train, even a ballad. You know, he's so intense, and beautiful human being, and you know, really great man.
And he's still touring.
He's still doing it.
So, with your hectic schedule, do you ever get a chance to practice?
I practice all the time. I practice when I'm on the road. When I'm not on the road, I have a sort of a regimen that I do. I like to wake up and, you know, have a little breakfast, but go to my practice room. And, you know, I work on a number of things. Sometimes I usually start with some technique, maybe some different scales. I usually play some Bach in the morning, a few Bach pieces that I'm working on, violin concerto, violin sonatas and partitas, as well as the Bach cello suites. It's an ongoing study for me through life. But that gets my technique in a... I love Bach's music and the solidness of the harmonic-ness of it and the melodicness of it. And the Bach, the cello suites especially, and the violin get me out of the bass range and allow me to play my technique. And I also work on, as I mentioned earlier, transcribing different people's solos. If I hear a line, I've been listening to some Wes Montgomery and trying to get some lines for that, because the bass guitar is a guitar, you know, it's mm-hmm. from the guitar family, different than the acoustic bass, which I also play, but mostly play electric bass. So that's basically what I do. I always have a tape machine, a little tape player, a mini disc man, mm-hmm. mini disc player recorder right next to me. And a lot of times I'll just start playing on a scale and I like to just sort of leave it open and see what comes up. And a lot of times I come up with ideas and I record them, because otherwise I would forget them in a minute, you know. and those become compositions later. They've been little seeds of compositions. So I'm always, you know, trying to work on my technique and keep it up there. You know, it's similar to sports, like an athlete. You know, you have to, especially the finger dexterity, and you just can't lay off, because it becomes evident very quickly in your playing.
Do you still get a chance to play the trumpet?
No, I don't. I don't play trumpet anymore. I put it down many years ago. I had a really good sound, and I played a lot of jazz in Miami in the jazz band. I played the jazz chair, second trumpet. But when I got into bass, I went head over heels into bass fanatically, and I applied all the music from my trumpet knowledge and my reading from 10 years old, and I transferred it over to bass and sort of taught myself how to play bass, along with taking some lessons with different people, one of whom is Jaco. I took brief lessons with, as well as a bass player named Don Kaufman in Miami, who really got me into some of the basic bass technique things.
What was it like playing with Jaco?
Intense.
Exactly.
Very intense. Again, I had the awareness that I was in the presence of an innovator, which he was. I first met Jaco because we played in a big band together with Ira Sullivan and Joe DiOrio was in it, I think, and a number of top players in Miami, studio players, and you know, just really the high end players in Miami. And I had only been playing about 2 years at that time, but one of my instructors in Miami, Whit Seidner, he saw potential in me, and he got me into the jazz band, and he pushed me, you know. And if it wasn't for him, I might not have, you know, gotten so heavily into it, because he really pushed me and made me be in situations where I was the worst guy. And you really learn when you're around better players than yourself, you know, no matter what it is. You know, if you're around people that know more than you, you know, it rubs off on you. And I've always been in those situations, sort of an underdog. And, you know, a lot of times I've rose to the occasion. And so this was one of those bands that I was asked to play in, and I was sort of felt like the great imposter, but I was competent to play in it. But, you know, it was just, I always feel like I could be better. But anyway, Jaco was also in that band, two electric bass players, not playing simultaneously, but Jaco was playing in a group with Ira Sullivan, separate from this big band. Ira had written some big band charts, Domingo and another one, I forgot, Amelia. Mm-hmm. Jaco brought these charts, and Ira said, hey, I want this bass player to play these charts. And so that's when I first met him, and I was astounded with what I heard. You know, you have to remember, he was pretty much fully formed then. This is in 72 or 73, and he was completely straight as far as no drinking or drugs, and a real family man, into sports. Wow. And was just, I'd never heard anything like it. I had been listening to Stanley Clark around that time, who was playing great and still is. But Jaco had a different thing. It was more on the electric bass, and he was just a different style, different thing. So I listened to his music, and we became friends then. And then that summer, maybe a few months later, he was taught a workshop at the University of Miami as an adjunct faculty. He came in and asked if he wanted any students. So I got together with him twice and took a couple lessons. But he used to come over to my house and play piano, and I played bass, and we played bass together. So I feel more that we were contemporaries, not that I was in his league by any stretch of the imagination. But I did, a lot of it rubbed off on me. And I would say what rubbed off on me was his intensity and the energy that he put into the instrument. And it was his energy that led him to be an innovator. You know, you always wonder when people are really gifted what they're going to be before they've found it, you know. And some people become incredible scientists or writers, and Jaco, just because of his upbringing with his father being a musician and music was all around, became a bass player. He was a true musical genius, I feel.
Yeah. Do you remember the first jazz concert that you ever attended?
Let's see. I remember the first rock concert was Hendrix.
Oh, yeah? That's a good start.
In 1968, I saw Jimi Hendrix in Rhode Island. Wow. Let me see.
Was he with Mitch then, or was it Buddy Miles sometimes?
It was the original band.
Oh, it was the original band. Eh?
Yeah, it was with Noel Redding. Mitch Mitchell. That was great. The first concert I probably saw was Cannonball Adderley with his group at the University of Miami when I went down there. Okay. They had a real strong student entertainment committee at the University of Miami, and we had... they brought in a lot of good groups. Miles came in with the Bitches Brew Band and played. Mahavishnu Orchestra was there. Larry Coryell, my former bandmate now, who I actually spent some time with Larry down there. He doesn't remember it, but I was walked around with him around the student union.
Wow.
Who else was there? Those are some of the early concerts that I saw.
Yeah, and did they leave a lasting impression on you?
Big time.
Yeah.
Huge. You know, seeing that, I was just so thirsty to go to New York and be plugged into the mainstream of what was going on. Mm. I realized that there was some very heavy music out there that I wanted to be around and wanted to play, you know. Mm. And so I actually, when Mahavishnu played there I met Rick Laird, the bass player. At that time, that was a great experience. And seeing Miles, at that time, Dave Holland was playing with him. And Jack DeChinette.
That's right.
It was a Bitches Brew band. So that was great. And I later went on to study with Dave Holland in New York when I moved to New York in 76 on acoustic bass, which was a great, great experience for me.
Oh, he's an amazing bassist.
Amazing and a great teacher and a great person.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very nice. Do you come from a musical family?
I do. No one played professionally. My father played trumpet in the army band, and my mother played piano at home. And my brothers and sisters all played an instrument. My brother played trombone. My younger brother, David, played drums, and my sister played piano.
So when did you first start to get into music? Like, was it at an early age?
It was an early age. I think third grade. I remember in the third grade, one of the guys in my class brought in a guitar and played a blues or something in front of the whole class. And I thought that was so neat. And I asked to take guitar lessons at that point. And I did for maybe 6 months or so. And I don't think I had a good teacher or I'm not sure, but I didn't follow through with it. And then the next year in school, they came around and asked us what instruments we wanted to play. And I was attracted to the trumpet because my father had played trumpet. And so I took up the trumpet. But I was always involved with it. From that point on, I played in the little elementary school bands, and I took lessons, and then I went to junior high school, and I played in the junior high school. See, at that time, we had assemblies every Friday in junior high school, and the junior high school orchestra always played as they came in, the people marched in and marched out of the assemblies, as well as they put on plays and musicals, Pirates of Penzance and things like that, and so I was always playing, and I was always getting out of class to go to rehearsal, and I liked that. Yeah. And I'd always be able to get these passes that would say, you know, I could go walk through the corridor, and, you know. This is I don't know what year this was, but the 60s, early 60s. So, you know, it was strict then.
So
dress codes, hair.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, definitely. I remember that. Yeah, very, very strict. At what point in your life did you decide that you wanted to pursue a vocation in music? I don't want to say career here. I want to say vocation because that's
vocation.
What it is.
Yeah, I think I always did. I know when I got into high school, I was also into oceanography. I was a scuba diver. I am an advanced open water scuba diver. Advanced. I mean, I've passed, you know, I've done some night dives and I've dove a lot all over the world, actually. But in high school, at that time, Vietnam was happening. And it was important that I knew that I didn't want to go to the war. I didn't believe in it. I didn't want to fight. And I wanted to go to college. I always knew I would play music, but I didn't think that music was a thing that you go to college for. I always thought that I should go and do some business or something. And that was probably more the practical side my parents were saying to me, even though my parents completely supported me to do whatever I wanted to do. It's sort of what I self-imposed on myself. And I think, you know, you have to look at the word paradigm, but the way that I saw things and my impression of a professional musician was my trumpet teacher. And what did he do? He had students, and nothing against teachers because, you know, that's why we're all here, is because of being taught to do whatever. But I felt like I could do more than that, that I would always play music, I'd always play in bands and everything, but that I didn't want to be a trumpet teacher because I wanted more vocationally out of my life. I think I had a great model from my parents. My father was a very successful businessman, had his own company and companies, and my mother also worked as a occupational therapist. So they were all professionals, you know, and I was going for more. I wanted more success, and not necessarily monetarily, but just I was always taught to really strive for a lot. So I applied at the University of Miami for not music, but for oceanography, to make a long story longer. I got accepted in oceanography, and the summer before I was going to go, I started to think about, wait a minute, I'm really not a scientist. I like to scuba dive, but I don't think by going to school I'm going to just scuba dive all the time. And I remember talking to my mother and saying, you know, I really am a musician. That's what, and she said, yes, you are. and you should study music. You know, so my mother said, do it. And so I reapplied at the university because I happened to check out that they had a good jazz department there with an incredible teacher, Jerry Coker, who had just started the program a few years before. It was a very small enrollment. There were only 30 jazz majors at the time. And I wanted to move out of Boston. I wanted to get away from the nest. Mm-hmm. I knew that Berkeley was a good school. But like I said, I felt like it'd be a good change to get away. And so I went and went to the University of Miami as a trumpet player. I got accepted, and I gradually, the next year, I switched over to bass as a bass player because I brought my bass with me, and someone heard me play bass, and they asked me to do a gig, and next thing I knew, I was in demand as a bass player.
So, it's amazing how these things happen.
It is. I was a professional trumpet player for 15 years. I was a trumpet player. So it's interesting how things change, and I think, you know, to any of your listeners out there, you know, if they were to ask me, you know, what kind of advice would you offer? And I would say to really go for your dream, you know, that you're the only one that holds yourself back. And it's, I know that as a fact, because if someone was to ask me, you know, in high school, well, you think you'll be a bass player? I said, no, I'm a trumpet player. I don't, you know, whatever, I'm doing this. Or, you know, you never know, and you just have to be open and really go for it. So,
if you weren't playing music, what could you see yourself doing?
I wonder about that. My wife, we were talking about that, and I wouldn't be a doctor. I wouldn't. I don't know. Maybe I would have taken over my father's company, which was a plastic business, which he fabricated things out of plexiglass. And although I know that wasn't for me either, I probably would have been involved in some type of business, I think. But I don't know what it would be. I know I do enjoy, I have a record company as well.
Wavetone, yeah.
Wavetone Records, which I've had since 1993. And I enjoy working with that and doing that type of business. So I know that I do have an affinity towards that. I like the aspect of the marketing aspect of it. The only thing I don't like is that it takes time away from playing. But I do have a few people to help me with the business, so it's alleviated a lot of that and allows me to tour. But I like calling the creative shots. I like producing a lot. I've produced quite a few records, and I enjoy that creative aspect a lot. So if I wasn't playing, I would enjoy running my record company and producing different artists. I think I could do that.
So Wavetone was set up more as a way of maintaining creative control over what you're doing? Was that the idea behind it?
Yes, Wavetone Records was, I had always wanted for years before that to start my own record label, because there were things that I was involved in, some very, very avant-garde projects that would slip through the cracks or no one would really want to put out, but I felt that I wanted to put out as a representation of what I do, and I thought that there would be people to listen to it. And it wasn't until 1993 when the group that I co-lead with Danny Gottlieb called Elements,
right.
We did a record, we did a live recording in Japan. We played a week at a place called the... can't remember the name of it. I'm getting old. Keystone Corner. Anyway, we did that, and we recorded every night, and that became we had the rights to that, to release that, and that became the first three releases, actually, on Wavetone. And I was able to put those out because I had a very low overhead. You know, I just had to pay the musicians and the manufacturing costs, but there were no studio costs for it. I also re-released one of my previous records that had been distributed to Wyndham Hill called Mosaic.
Right.
So I got my feet wet in the company that way. And it was, as you had asked me, it was a way to provide an outlet for creative projects, and so that I wouldn't have to go to a record company and present a demo and be worried if they weren't going to take the next project. And so it was
It's funny because when I first found out that you had started up Wavetone, I couldn't help but think of Charles Mingus when he started up his label many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Debut Records, if I'm not mistaken.
You know, I don't know what the name.
Or Candid? Or...
Well, I'm not sure.
It was one of those, but it was for that. It was just to, you know, have his say in the matter rather than having a big monolithic record company calling the shots.
Right. And, I was sort of early for, you know, now there's a lot of independent labels now, but when I did, there weren't that many independent labels in the early 90s. I mean, there were a number, but it wasn't the way it is today. But, you know, I also got very frustrated with record companies and the pressure. They'd say, well, we want this, you know, we want to get airplay with this next record on, you know, at that time, CD-101, before it was really smooth. Because I don't consider myself a smooth jazz type of player, even though a couple of things I've done have gotten airplay and sort of fit in the cracks, and I've performed on smooth jazz recordings. A couple have come to mind, Chuck Loeb. Mm-hmm. Who else? There's a couple, but
who's still out there playing? I like Chuck's playing. Yeah.
Yes, Chuck is great. Yeah. Chuck is a really great player, gifted, and a good friend too. We've played a lot of studio work together and toured with Michael Franks. Since I feel that my music fits in the cracks a lot because it's, you know, I don't consider myself smooth jazz. I don't consider myself straight ahead, really, in the terms of straight ahead jazz. So there aren't a lot of labels that put that type of music out.
It all comes down to music.
Right. And I just didn't want any restrictions as far as that. And yes, you do get restricted in that, you know, having the resources of a small independent label are difficult to do what a major label could do. But, you know, it's worked out really well because now I have 11 releases out on the label. And and I've put out other people's records, Joe Beck, Jeff Champa, as well as a trio that I did with Jeff Lapson and Danny Gottlieb, a very avant-garde trio record. Mm-hmm. I just feel really strongly about it. And to me, now I just want to put out creative music. That's it. I'm thinking about the music more than anything else.
Yeah, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
If you wanted to create a, this is kind of a weird question to ask you, seeing it as you've played with so many people during your career, if you want to form a dream band, who would it consist of?
Probably a couple of bands. For one version, more of a funk groove with an outside edge to it would be with drummer Steve Jordan. This is the groove one, with a few guitar players. I'm thinking of doing like a, not Bitches Brew, but a, and not jam band, but a groove oriented record with a lot of improvisation on it. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, I always feel like if there's a groove, it can carry anything. You know, you can have some really outside music on top of a groove, and it's people latch onto a groove. I think it's a human nature thing. I don't know why, but I just know that it's something that you can latch onto. But other players, like possibly Dave Liebman, this is for the funk thing, for the groove thing. So he'd be on top of it. Maybe Joey DeFrancesco playing organ, because I like the sound of organ. I also would like to have an acoustic guitar player. I'm trying to think who, but Eric Weisberg comes to mind, great acoustic player. Sam Bush, one of these players. And do a groove thing. That would be a fun band to do. And saxophonist Bill Evans, one of my longtime buddy and partner in crime. And then for a more straight-ahead thing, maybe I'd like to do something. Well, it's sort of close to what I've done. I'd like to play with Jack DeJohnette, John Abercrombie. Excuse me. And I'm hearing that in conjunction with some world flavorings, maybe with a tabla player, conga player, some drums, that sort of thing. So I know a few people. So those are some of the areas that I'm looking at. You know, and I didn't name all the players, but I'd have to research more to find out who they were. But along those lines, with some great improvisers.
Now, there's a guitarist in Sweden that I've been more or less working with over the years. I had a chance to interview him as well, Anatoly Bulkin. You're familiar with his
Yes. Team. Yeah, we were talking about doing some recording and a tour at one time, and hopefully we will sometime.
That would be pretty interesting because he's very influenced by Pat's playing.
Yes.
When I was talking with him, it was... Now, you've been playing a great deal around New York. Do you find that you're able to get a lot of work still?
You know, there's a lot less work than there used to be. Not nearly as much recording work, and a lot of the club work is, you really couldn't survive on it, really, you know, because it's, you know, it just doesn't pay enough to do it that much. But I think more so, the work around New York is more of the vital work, where you get to really play with players who are really intent on playing hard, and they know that they're on the scene, and so they're in the mainstream. So I like that aspect of it. But for me, I really have to work worldwide to really make ends meet and tour, you know, all over the world, and a lot in Europe and Japan. And so that's, for me, I would say most of my income and most of my work comes from more traveling than it does studio work, which is a big transition from what it used to be for me. I used to be mostly in the studio and just a bit of touring, you know, but I grew up as a player and I've always wanted to be a player, and that's what I do. So it really makes sense for me.
Have you ever played in a talk show band?
I subbed in a band, a few. Well, Saturday Night Live, that's not really a talk show band. Mm. There was one called New York Today or something, and I subbed in a couple of those bands for various players, but I never did a steady one. That would be good. That'd be fun.
That'd be kind of neat. I know that the name escapes me now. Who's playing with Jay Leno's band?
Will Lee.
The guitarist. I can't remember his name at the moment.
Robin. Not Robin, his brother.
Yeah.
Eubanks, Kevin.
That's right, Kevin Eubanks, yeah.
Kevin Eubanks, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, great. That's great. He's really made that into a great thing, and, yeah. You know, as is the Letterman band, you know.
Oh, definitely. Do you find any time to teach at all?
I don't. I'm traveling and working so much that I don't. Occasionally, I mentor some different people, mm-hmm. and when I say mentor, I'll get together with a sort of like a brush-up type of lesson or a get-together where I'll just pile a lot of different ideas and things to work on. But I don't have time. I have in the past, but as of late, I don't have time to do anything on a steady basis because I'm sort of on call a lot. I've been touring a lot with Larry Coryell, with my own trio, with Danny Gottlieb and John Abercrombie. So I really can't do it on a steady basis. And when I do have time, I've been more composing my own music and practicing my own music. So
speaking of touring, what was the most memorable gig that you've ever had?
Wow. Probably playing with the Gil Evans Orchestra with Giacco in Japan. We did a tour where it was two bass players, Giacco and I, with the Gil Evans Orchestra. And that was probably one of the memorable ones.
Do you find that the crowds are different in Japan as compared to the States in terms of their enthusiasm and just knowledge of the music?
You know, I do find them different. I find they're very knowledgeable. They're very polite, as you would imagine, as it's built into the culture of not with all Japanese, but especially when you're in Japan, it's very, it's a very listening type of culture. You know, people in general, when you speak to people in the street or you know, have a conversation, people listen, and I think it carries over into the music. And I think that there are audiences for all the different styles of music there, and they're very avid fans.
Mm.
Very, very supportive, and they've done a lot of research and a lot of listening, and they know their jazz and rock and funk and classical music.
Do you have any road stories that you'd like to share with us?
Well, let's see. I remember being in the van with Pat Metheny, going on. I'm not sure the road that goes through Ohio. It's one of the I-90 or one of those. And what reminds me of is today is the similar weather conditions. As I look up my window, I'm in Warwick, New York right now, and it's snowing, and it's like sort of ice snow.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's nasty. We're supposed to get about 11, 12 inches of snow. I like it. I like the vibe of it. But we were in a van traveling, and we just stopped this is in 1976. We had just stopped on the way and gotten some fried chicken or something, and I was eating a drumstick in the back of the van. At that time, we were traveling probably across the whole United States, and the road turned to solid ice, and we went off the road and flipped, did a complete 360, but I still had the chicken leg in my hand. And we were all okay. Thank God we were all okay. And we made it out okay. But that was kind of one of the stories. There's so many stories. Oh, my God. I've traveled so much.
Yeah, you must have logged a lot of hours on the road.
I've been to Europe for probably 100 times, something like that. This last time in Japan was my 26th time. I just got back with Larry Coryell from a trip to Russia and Poland. That was my first time in Russia. The only places that I haven't been are, let me see.
Antarctica?
I haven't been to Antarctica. Thank you. But I've been a lot up into Canada. I know you're in Canada.
Right.
And another side of me that, aside from music, is I'm a big avid fisherman. And my good friend Bill Evans, a saxophonist, and I, and a friend from Chicago named Pooh, go fishing up into the boundary waters and into Canada in the provincial park of Quetico.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done many expeditions. I've probably spent, since 1989, about 6 months in the woods.
Wow.
That's a long time in the woods.
Do you get any inspiration from the animals in the woods musically?
I get inspiration from the spirit of the woods, from the from the sense of the peaked sense of nature, from being, because we would go, the longest I was out one time was a month. And, you know, that's a long time to be out. We never go inside anything other than a tent, but, you know, it's a fishing trip with canoes and you go from lake to lake. And it's just a boyhood dream for me because I grew up fishing in Massachusetts when I grew up in Brockton and Bridgewater, Mass. And it's just a great experience, and it brings a lot, that spirit of the nature and the flow of energy that goes, that you really get to witness when you're away from city life and automated life and cars and moving, and it's all just about the weather, and you're watching the clouds, and, you know, the whole day depends on, will be able to canoe against this wind, or will the fishing be good because it's too bright out, you know.
Yeah. And so The reason why I mention that is because many years ago, Dave Holland released an amazing album called
Conference of the Birds.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that really inspired me quite a bit. What he really wanted to did. Yeah.
Big time. I remember when that came out. And as a matter of fact, around that time, I was playing acoustic bass in Florida. No, in Cape Cod for the summer. And I took my upright bass and my bow, and I went out on the back porch. And this was every day I would do this in the morning, and I would just wait for bird calls. And I would imitate them. And I'd play them in all different keys and modulate them and playing them all around. And I would just, it seemed to make total sense. It probably sounds like I'm totally crazy, but there's so much sound out there. There's so many pitches and different things. And it was great ear training to pick it out on the instrument and make something out of it. So I related totally to Conference of the Birds, and I'm a big fan of Dave Holland's and in nature, and I got a lot of inspiration from spending the time in the woods.
Well, I remember years ago there was a story that Dexter Gordon was sitting at a bus station, and just the sound of the sound that the wheels were making as they were coming into the station, he was thinking of basing a song around that, like composing a song around that. You know, always thinking and always listening.
Right, you know, right, and that's the huge thing about music that you have to be open to is listening.
Are there any up and coming artists that you're excited about?
You know, well, there are. I'm trying to think of some names other than up and coming. Most of the people that I know are established. You know.
There's one I could think of. I don't know if he's still up and coming, but Matt Garrison.
Oh, see, that's what I mean. I know a ton of those people, like Matt Garrison and Victor Wooten and the new bass player with John McLaughlin, who I just saw him in New York, which is Farad, Harad, can't remember his name, but phenomenal bass player. He plays faster, not that fast is everything, but with more technique than Jaco had.
Wow.
Just phenomenal. Another level of it. Now, where he takes it is will be interesting to see, and I, you know, he has my thoughts are with him wherever he takes it musically, but he's got it. Huge way. And Matthew Garrison, of course, is great. You know, I just, there's so many people that are expressing such great things on not only bass, but all the instruments.
When you're composing, what is it about it that you enjoy so much?
I like the surprise element of it for me. And I like the fact of the creative aspect of it, because it's, for me, the way I compose are different modes of it, but basically I come up with an idea, whether it be on the piano or an electric keyboard or a drum groove or something. And a lot of times I'll just start with one idea and just keep adding on to it. And it's sort of like a little puzzle. It's like doing an add-on puzzle and inverting things. And I like the creative aspect of it. It's hard to describe. How could I describe it better? Not necessarily the control of it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to mention something that I asked so many musicians about. Is, you know, when you're a child and you're playing with stuff and you tear it apart, then you build it up again, maybe mold it into something different.
Right.
And a lot of musicians that I've spoken with have caught on to that notion that that's how they create their music.
That is the way it is. It starts with one thing, and one thing goes to the next and inspires something else. And the nice thing of it is the surprise that I don't know where it's going, but it's going somewhere. Mm. And inevitably, and this always happens with me, I'll say, okay, because practicing sessions and writing sessions are completely two different things. I can't be thinking about technique. When I'm writing, I'm there to work on songs and develop certain things. I'll start one thing and I always end up with another, and that's okay. I think most song I've ever written, I've started, gone to the keyboard to start something, and then I noodle around and it leads somewhere else, and I follow that. And if I can't finish it that day, or if I can't finish it in, you know, within a reasonable period of time, I'll just put it away, because if it's a really good idea, what I think is something that could be good, I don't want to waste it and write something stupid that's going to, just to complete it. So. And a lot of my songs I'm still working on. I come back to songs I wrote 20 years ago, and I'll add little things and little notes, because I'm learning new things. You know, harmonically I've gotten more adept at the theoretical things, and the more I listen to, the more that I hear, and the more that I want to do.
But don't you find that to be an exhilarating experience?
Absolutely. To me, that's the creativeness of the... the beauty of the creative process.
The ultimate high, I would think.
It is, and it's. I get that same feeling from playing, because I like to play improvised music, and I get the same feeling. It's funny, but I've done a little bit of painting with acrylics, and I painted a couple of things, and I felt the same thing. I felt that same energy, and I love that energy, and I can relate to artists. And really, it's about the being in the moment for me that I really like.
Yeah.
It pulls me into the moment, into the presence of doing something, and I really like that. But it's a special thing. You know, composing, there's so many ways to approach it. You know, you can start out with a groove, or like, okay, today I'm going to write a waltz or something in 3/4. Or I really like this tempo, this type of groove, because I like to, you know, and then that's a starting point. That's a jump-off point. But to me, in composition, it all has to start from a groove. And the way I define a groove is any type of rhythmic movement. A groove could be a ballad is a groove to me. You know, so some of the things where it starts.
So when you're in the studio recording one of your own albums, does it take you a long time to go through the process of recording it, or do you just tend to do it in one or two takes?
It depends on the record. The recording that was released before my previous one was called Freedom Town, and that was a very produced album. When I say produced, there were a lot of parts that were overdubbed, different people brought in not at the same time, different times. Tracks were sent different places to be overdubbed on. And that process takes a lot longer. And this is all this is separate from the mixing process. That's a whole thing that always takes time.
Yeah.
And is always, you know, trial and error and many different things. The other side of the coin is the last record that I did, which is called As We Speak. And that was a trio with John and Danny, John Abercrombie and Danny Gottlieb. And that was pretty much first or second takes, all of it. And it's a trio. And it's very, when I wrote for that particular record, it was very inspired by and based around the Gateway Trio recordings with Jack DeJohnette, Dave Holland, and John Abercrombie, which I've been a big fan of that group. And I wanted to do an electric version of that, more of an electric. And so Abercrombie would bring in the Gateway factor, and Danny's sort of like a younger brother of Jack DeJohnette. And I don't know what I am, but I'm no Dave Holland. But I wanted that type of sensibility because I can really listen to those records, and I wanted to make a record that atmospherically you could listen to, but yet there was a lot of improvisation, and it wasn't completely free, although there are some tunes on it that were improvisations. So that record we did in 2 days, to make a long story short. Whoa.
So when you're composing or recording, do you use any computer tools at all, like Pro Tools or Sibelius?
I do. I use Sibelius. I use Pro Tools mostly for the recording aspect, but I use a sequencer called Digital Performer by Motu. And that's pretty much what I learned writing on, and that's what I compose a lot on. And I'll use that in such a way as I'll possibly play a little drum groove on it, or maybe I'll play a piano, little piano riff, or I might come up with, there might be some synthesizer sound that I like, and that inspires, and I'll get that going, and then I'll start playing my bass on top of it and playing melodies, and then I'll say, oh, I like that melody, and I'll add on to that, and then I'll have that, and then I'll replace the drums with real drums and a real keyboard player, or recut the whole thing, and that's just purely a demo. And
So when you're on the road, you'll record tidbits here and there probably to use later on maybe? Is that?
Sometimes. Now, the way that laptops are and the way that, you know, recording live is, especially with this last tour that I did with my group with John Abercrombie and Danny Gottlieb, we recorded every night. And not only that, but we videoed every night. Wow. And so what I intend to do is put out a DVD of that tour, and, you know, intercut different parts of different songs and try to put different things. So I do that. And on the road, I also use GarageBand, which is a Mac application, and it's great for writing, you know, on the road. I can plug in and play and get little ideas, really get them up fast.
So you find a lot of value in that software to
I find value in the software. I'm way into the technology. I never was afraid of it, and I embraced it. I also embrace humanness and creativity, and know when to, you know, put the machines away and just write with a pad of paper, because I've written a lot of things that way, and I think, you know, the basic music comes from that. But it depends on the style and the direction that you're moving in. You know, sometimes you need to start with a more of an electronic palette and superimpose your musical spirit over that.
Yeah. Have you ever thought of playing in a bass choir? I'm thinking of the World Bass Violin Ensemble with Rufus Reed and Fred Hopkins and Brian Smith. And I was wondering if you've ever been interested in playing in that kind of a situation.
You know, I would be interested in that. I've played sometimes with two bass players. And on some of my records, I've overdubbed myself many times doing a sort of a bass choir type of thing. But it would be fun. I would be interested in doing that. It's not something that I'm pursuing right now, but yeah, I certainly would be open to that. I think there could be some great potential with that.
Yeah, I think it's because the bass lends itself to beautiful harmonics as well.
Yes.
You know.
It's a beautiful the timbre of the instrument and the spectrum of the instrument, especially now with all the different instruments, with the 5-string and 6-string instruments, they can widen the gap of only staying in within 4 strings and within a certain range of music.
Mm-hmm. Miles Davis and Art Blakey are two of the most, I think, famous schools of music for up-and-coming musicians. It seems that now formal education is at the forefront. We seem to have lost the apprenticeship from bands like Miles and Art that offered musicians. Do you have any comments on this?
I do. I think the great bands and the great schools that were created, if you want to call them schools, but like the Miles Davis, all the bands that he had, I think there's a big loss from not having that. And now you have different type of educational systems and schools trying to create an environment where people can plug in and do that. But there's really nothing like being on the bandstand and being forced to play. And, you know, for young players, I just try to tell them, just try to be around any type of a scene that where there's good players playing and try to plug into that type of creative playing. But there's really a lack of that now. And
I remember...
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I just remembered a quote that Art Blakey made years ago saying that if you're going to make a mistake, make sure it's nice and loud.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's, forgot that.
That's a great saying. But those were great training grounds, or, you know, with people playing in those bands. I mean, you were just right in the forefront of what's happening. And, you know, even the late Joe Zawinul was a great provider of an environment like that. You know, he had all young players and great bands and was one of the last of those guys to do that.
Did you ever play with him at all?
I never played with Joe Zawinul.
What a musician, man.
What a musician, incredible. I got to meet him because we played in some festivals together, and he was a great man.
Yeah. So what's left for Mark Egan to do?
Oh, everything. Oh, just continue, continue growing my playing, my expression on the instrument, become a better improviser, a better groove player, you know, taking the technique and the music further, writing more records, keeping doing that, more of my own tours, which I've enjoyed for the last 2 years doing that since the trio record. And I intend on doing that. I've mostly, actually exclusively, done those tours in Europe. But hopefully I can do some tours in the States. I enjoyed it.
Is there any setting that you prefer playing in?
I enjoy any setting where there are great players playing, where the music isn't confined, and where people are listening, and there's an understanding that you're there to go for it, and you're playing as a team, you know. Mm. And it could be a lot of different things. It could be a lot of different circumstances. I'm about to go out on the road in January with Bill Evans, with his group Soulgrass.
Right.
And he just asked me to do that. And I'm going to also go play with Dave Weckl and Bill in Germany to the WDR Big Band. And that's a great, another different type of outlet, but it's, you know, it's a great, very intense music, and it should be a lot of fun. So it could be a lot of, stylistically, there are many different type of areas I like to do. I also enjoy playing trio format, as I do with my own, and also with Larry Coryell's trio, which we've been together for 5.5 years now, with Paul Vertico.
Do you still find it fun touring?
I find it fun playing, and I find it difficult logistically getting to places, and that gets tired. And, you know, like Dorothy said from The Wizard of Oz, there's no place like home, you know?
Yeah.
And I miss my wife, and I miss my friends and my family, and so I love being out there and playing the vital music, but it's tough touring, especially now the way, you know, flying and going through security checks. And, you know, this last tour we did in Europe with Larry in Russia, we were played one day, we had one day off, and the day off, we had to get up at 4 a.m. almost every day and travel all day to get to the next location. We only got about 2 hours sleep, so, you know, it's easier to do an all-nighter when you're, you know, in your 20s and early 30s, but, you know, I'm now 56, and it's harder. It takes a while to catch up, you know, and so it's rough, but there's no other way to do it. Yeah. If you want to get out and play music, you've got to tour, or you've got to hit the road, you know. So, you know, there's an aspect of it that I like. Once you get out there, there aren't a lot of day-to-day distractions, like at home where you pay the bills, you have to go here, you have to go there, but, you know, when you get home, you have to take care of all of it. So it's a double-edged sword. but I don't see any other way.
Yeah. Speaking of tools of the trade, how has the internet affected you as a musician?
It's made things really fast. I have to say that I was never into writing letters. Hmm. And when I first opened up email and realized that, oh, I have to write back everyone, it was a chore for me. And I still, you know, I'm not a great typer, but it's just that's tough for me. The thing that I like about it is the immediacy and to be able to transfer files. Obviously, you know, I have a .Mac account where a server where I can people can send me files and download files, and I can work on music at my studio. I have a full-blown recording studio where I record my records at. And so the technology, as I said before, I embrace the technology.